From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Donald Trump is about to become the first president in U.S. history to be impeached twice. At this hour, the House of Representatives is debating an article of impeachment against the president after pro-Trump extremists stormed the Capitol a week ago. Today, Democratic Representative Kathy Ann Castor of Florida said President Trump is to blame for the attack, and she demanded accountability.
The traitorous incitement of an insurrection demands not just impeachment, but removal of office from office immediately.
And here's Republican Tom Cole of Oklahoma.
We are coming off a horrific event that resulted in 6 deaths. We have an opportunity to move forward, but we cannot if the majority insists on bringing the country through the trauma of another impeachment.
Democratic Senator and Whip Dick Durbin of Illinois joins us now. Senator, it's good to speak with you.
Thank you.
This has never happened before, a president about to be impeached for the second time. How does the gravity of that weigh on you?
Having lived through January 6, 2021, after seeing the videos of what had happened in the Capitol while the Senate was immobilized and ultimately removed from the chamber, I don't believe this president deserves to serve another hour as president of the United States.
Just want to let listeners know you are on a cell phone. That's why it's hard to hear you. We just heard Republicans like Tom Cole say that this impeachment vote is rushed, that it will further divide an already wounded country. Is there not truth to the fact that this country is too hurt to do this again?
I can tell you there has to be accountability for what happened. This president has to answer for inciting a terrorist mob with guns, pipe bombs, Molotov cocktails, violent confrontations, with law enforcement officers ultimately killing one of them who's just doing his duty, and innocent people dying as well. Yes, the president has to be held accountable for it. To say this was just another bad day in the Capitol is to overlook the obvious. This president should be removed from office.
I know you've heard the reporting from the New York Times and others that leader Mitch McConnell in the Senate is pleased that impeachment could purge the president of the Republican Party, but we also see his spokesman tweeting today that McConnell will not move up a Senate trial before the inauguration. What are you hearing about timing in the Senate?
Well, it is likely that we'll be unable to take up this issue until after President-elect Biden is sworn into office on January 20th. But it is within the power and authority of Mitch McConnell to make that happen sooner. If the House votes the articles of impeachment, we should be called back into Washington immediately to do that.
From your reading of the Constitution, does it even allow for an impeachment trial if the president is no longer in office?
Well, there's no clarity because we've never faced anything quite like this before. But I believe that the fact that this president will be the first to have been impeached twice in office speaks for itself. And I think the Senate should move forward. We should have an actual trial. The last time we had a trial on President Trump's impeachment, if you'll remember, Senator McConnell would not allow us to produce any evidence or witnesses. Well, the fact of the matter is we don't need that presentation. We're eyewitnesses to many of us, or eyewitnesses to what actually occurred.
Well, and last time you also only had one Republican to join you in voting to convict, Senator Mitt Romney of Utah. You need 67. That would mean 17 Republicans. How close are you to that number?
We haven't taken account. It's not the type of thing that you whip like an ordinary amendment or bill. But I'll tell you, the statements that were made by members of the Republican majority in the Senate of what they saw and what they witnessed and the way they voted, incidentally, on the electoral vote tells me that they were shaken as much as the Democrats.
Yesterday, 4,327 people in this country died of the coronavirus. Are you certain that a Senate can handle a trial, a raging pandemic, and confirm Joe Biden's cabinet at the same time? How will that work?
Yes. Yes, we can do that. And we will if it's the assignment of the House is to take up our constitutional responsibility, we will do it. Joe Biden as president will move quickly to do what's necessary to stem this pandemic, and we'll be there to help him. If we have to work a half day on the impeachment trial and a half day to make sure that those timely actions are taken, we can do it.
But there may be more disruptions. Senator, I know the security at the Capitol today is profound. There's major concern about threats ahead of the inauguration next week. Do you expect more violence? Is the Capitol prepared for the days ahead?
Well, we certainly were unprepared for what happened on January the 6th. And the law enforcement that was in place was overwhelmed. We've seen the videos of that. That's not going to happen again. If these people are so foolish as to come back to Washington, they're going to find a much different scene on Capitol Hill. Breaks my heart, I'll tell you. I've worked in and around that Capitol building most of my life. And to think that it's going to become locked down, a stronghold to protect the people who are inside, it hurts. It's a different America.
I can hear that in your voice. Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, a Democrat. Thank you for taking time for us on this historic day. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Days after supporters of President Donald Trump led a deadly siege on the U.S. Capitol, some lawmakers are facing backlash for their roles in inciting the riots. In St. Louis, Missouri, Republican Senator Josh Hawley was called out by his home state paper for being, quote, complicit in the deadly violence. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch also called for Hawley's resignation. For more on this, I'd like to welcome the paper's editor, Gilbert Bilone. Thanks for speaking with me about this.
No, thank you for having me.
Gilbert, last week your board published an editorial calling for Hawley to resign. I'm sure you didn't take that lightly. So can you explain the reason behind your decision to publish that piece?
Well, he has been one of the in the forefront of people who have been claiming the Electoral College vote was based on fraudulent votes. And we believe, as I think many Americans do, that has been tried. It had been tested in courts, and that is not true. And he continues to say that, as well as President Trump. And so both of them, we feel, were participants in this narrative that helped led to the attack on the Capitol. Now, whether that was their intent, I don't think that necessarily has to be the case. But the fact that they were proponents of that, and in the case of Josh Hawley, he represents our state. And even after the riot, he continued to oppose the certification of the vote in the Senate. And we believe that he's not going to change his mind, but we feel that it would be better if he were to resign.
Well, and if folks are thinking, oh, this is just criticism from the press, that's actually not the case. He's facing criticism within his own party, including from the former Missouri Senator John Danforth, who's been something of a mentor. He told the Associated Press on Thursday that supporting Josh Hawley was the worst decision I've ever made in my life. And Gilbert, I understand you're also receiving a lot of letters to the editor calling for Hawley to resign. What are you hearing from your audience?
Well, here in the St. Louis area, we have had a resounding and emphatic repudiation of Josh Hawley to us. In our area, the urban diverse area that has more of a Democratic base in it, and the rest of the state does not. We are hearing lots of letters, lots of people, huge numbers of people commenting on stories, a lot of social media, a lot of response to our editorials and our columns. We've had columnists also take the same tact. Josh Hawley's familiar to us. His rise was very quick. He was an AG and then quickly became a senator very rapidly. So we know him, but he has not been elected official for a long time, but he has some history here. So we're familiar with that.
You know, there's also been a response in the business community. In fact, a growing list of corporations are distancing themselves. Hallmark Cards, to name one, is demanding that Hawley return $7,000 that they had donated to his campaign. And so in some ways, Gilbert, that may raise questions about whether he can effectively fundraise to support a political future. But perhaps he's galvanized some support in a way in other corners. And so I'm curious what you make of his political prospects from here.
Well, first off, he has another 4 years to go on his Senate term, so he's not looking to run, at least, well, he may be running for president if some of the pundits are right. But at this point, he's probably not as worried about that, although it's true. There's some key Republican fundraisers here in town in Missouri, who have decided not to fund him anymore, and that's significant. These are large donors. So if that were to continue for the, you know, coming months and perhaps years, that could have an impact. We'll see what happens after this in the next few weeks, where that washes out. We had a very good Sunday story by Jack Suntrip, kind of looking at it as he gets in a defensive crouch nationally. What does that mean? And one of the local observers said that he wouldn't write his obit, and I would say I wouldn't either, given for this, that Missouri is a very red state. Trump and Governor Parson, who just got reelected, both had 57% of the vote in November. So there's a huge amount of support for him. The question is, what's going to happen after last week and the next coming weeks? What happens in Washington? What's going to happen with the Republican Party? Hawley really aligned himself with Trump, as the governor did, but Hawley in particular how that's going to portend in the future, we can't really tell. I think that's going to determine a lot of what his fate is. But Missouri is a very red state. The legislature is completely dominated by Republicans. All the statewide officials are Republicans. So I think he feels safe haven here. If he wants to go to a bigger stage, I think he's going to have a much harder climb after the last couple of weeks, given what people have seen on social media and in the news about what he said and how he's being viewed.
Yeah, Hawley was a politician to watch up until last week, and now he remains a politician to watch, although perhaps for some different reasons. Gilbert Bailone is the editor of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He joined us from Missouri. Gilbert, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Armed soldiers are protecting the U.S. Capitol today, and a growing number of Republicans are joining Democrats who are about to make President Trump the first president ever to be impeached twice, this time for inciting his supporters to riot last week while lawmakers were voting to certify the results of the presidential election. In the House this morning, there was heated debate. Here's Republican Jason Smith of Missouri, and then Massachusetts Democrat Jim McGovern.
This is a reckless impeachment. This will only bring up the hate and fire more than ever before. Put the people before politics.
Gentlemen's time's expired.
Let me remind all of my colleagues that what happened on Wednesday would not have happened if it weren't for the occupant in the White House. And if we want to put the people first, we all ought to vote to impeach him and remove him from office as soon as possible.
Our political strategists join us now. Bill Press is the Democrat, Alice Stewart, a Republican. Hello to you both.
Hi, Peter.
Alice, I need to start with you because this is a monumental moment for our country, but also, frankly, for your party. What kind of crossroads are we at today?
It's a challenging crossroads, without a doubt. There's great division within the party, but there's also division in the country. And it brings to mind Abraham Lincoln, who said years ago, a house divided against itself cannot stand. And what he was referring to in the division was slavery. And today we have a division based on dishonesty and incivility. And President Trump has been dishonest with the American people. And when you lie to the American people and you undermine the election process and you refuse to participate in a peaceful transfer of power, there are consequences. And while I did support this president, I have not supported his actions since November 3rd. And I strongly believe there should be consequences for the actions that he took in his role in inciting and inviting the insurrection.
By consequences, you mean impeachment?
Absolutely. Yes.
Bill, I know you're listening to the debate today. I'm sure you saw the pictures of National Guard troops sleeping in the Capitol building overnight. How are you taking in what you're seeing?
Well, I've seen it on television. I've seen it in person, too, Peter. I live near the Capitol. I walk by there every day. It's an armed fortress today, and it's very sad to see that. But unfortunately, it is necessary, given the security threats that we've had in the past, which some of which were ignored, but also the security threats moving forward for the next few days and for the inauguration. But, I mean, I think what we're seeing today is a sad moment. It's a solemn moment, but it's a necessary moment on the floor of the House. You know, we saw it last week, just a week ago, when the Senate and the House came back into session after the failed coup, after all of that destruction and loss of life, to fulfill their constitutional duties, to show that this republic still survives and is strong. And we see it today where the House is voting to hold responsible the person who is mainly responsible for that violence, namely the President of the United States. As Republican Governor, former Governor Chris Christie said, if inciting insurrection is not an impeachable offense, what is?
Well, in fact, Wyoming Republican Liz Cheney just excoriated the president yesterday when she said she would vote for impeachment. She also said there has never been a greater betrayal by a president. Alice, that felt significant. What did you think about it? Does it give cover to other Republicans who feel the same way? This is coming from the number three House Republican.
Well, sure, Peter. It felt significant because it really was. And yes, to your point, it does give cover to a lot of Republicans who may have had reservations about coming forward with regard to impeachment or even a censure for this president. I also believe the actions of Senator Tom Cotton also last week gave a lot of cover for Republicans who had concerns and reservations about whether or not they should oppose the certification of the electoral votes. And I am very proud to see one by one, Republican by Republican, taking a stand for what is right. And for no other reason, Peter, is to show that there are consequences for inciting an insurrection, but also sending a message that this kind of conduct cannot be tolerated. In your interview with Senator Durbin, you could feel the tension in his voice. And he indicated, look, we certainly can't do anything about what happened last week, but we need to take steps now and send messages that mob violence is not a peaceful protest and mob violence cannot be tolerated. And by taking a stand showing consequences for this president, it sends a message across the bow.
And yet some very conservative House members aren't really budging here. In fact, some have called on Liz Cheney to resign her leadership position because of what she said. Alice, just sticking with you for a moment, seriously, how badly is this fracturing the Republican Party?
It certainly is a concern right now. And when you see the Republicans that are standing by this president, they are very strong and resolute in their feelings that there is widespread fraud and voter problems in this country. But the facts are there is no basis for that argument. And if they would just acknowledge the fact there is no widespread voter fraud and there is no reason to question the outcome of the results of the election, there's no reason to continue this charade, the sooner they get to that point, the better we are. But those that believe that, for some reason, which I do not understand, are very strong in their convictions and they believe they are representing people back in their districts. But it is all based on factually inaccurate information. And that's a shame.
Under Trump, the GOP lost the White House, the House, and the Senate. It was the first time that's happened since Herbert Hoover back in 1932. And Bill, I'm remembering what Joe Biden said recently, that this country actually needs a strong and principled opposition. This is not something, in other words, that Democrats should be rejoicing about, this rift in the Republican Party. What do you think about that? Is the rupture damaging to the country?
Well, look, my first job in politics was working for a Republican. I handled several pieces of legislation that were actually signed into law in California by Republican Governor Ronald Reagan. I think we need two strong, viable political parties. And so, believe it or not, I think this is a turning point for the Republican Party. Not that anybody in the Republican Party has asked me for their advice. I think this is a turning point. They really have a choice to put Trump and Trumpism behind them. This is the moment. I salute Mitch McConnell for recognizing that and seeing that. I salute Tom Cotton, and I certainly salute Liz Cheney, not just Liz Cheney. Remember, her father is the one who led the effort to get 10 or 12 former defense secretaries to sign a letter saying President Trump was wrong in not recognizing that this was a fair election. I think this is a moment of truth for the Republican Party. I hope they see the way forward is to reject Donald Trump. I think this impeachment vote should be unanimous. How can anybody defend inciting sedition, inciting that kind of violence? I don't get it, but this is a moment for the Republican Party to do the right thing, and I hope it will.
It says a lot about where we are to hear a Democrat praise Dick Cheney. I want to listen to freshman Nancy Mace. Yeah, right, I'm sure. Here's House freshman Nancy Mace, a Republican from South Carolina today.
The U.S. House of Representatives has every right to impeach the President of the United States. But what we're doing today, rushing this impeachment in an hour or two-hour long debate on the floor of this chamber, bypassing judiciary, poses great questions about the constitutionality of this process. I believe we need to hold the president accountable.
We've been hearing Republicans say a lot about this, that this is too rushed, that it's going to split the party or the country even more. But I wonder, Bill, if it won't cause the president to lash out again, if it won't cause or ensure the fact that the president will pardon himself, which he has been considering. What do Democrats do in that case?
There's nothing you can do. But first, just in terms of rushing, look, this is one article of impeachment and 2 hours of debate. I mean, if the House cannot handle that, then they might as well all go home. I mean, that's such a ridiculous argument. But notice, they can't defend the president, so they come back, she comes back, and others do, on process again. It's such a weak, lame argument. It's almost embarrassing. If the president, who knows what the president's going to do in the next few days? I think he may be considering, reportedly, pardoning himself. If he does, I still think he's not out of legal trouble, certainly not in the state of New York, and maybe not even at the federal level after what he incited last week.
Alice, what do you think? Do you agree?
Well, I think, look, as we've said, if an insurrection and inviting an insurrection at the state capitol, the U.S. capitol, is not a reason for impeachment, I'm certainly not aware of what would be. And if not now, when? And it's not as though they're digging through secret documents as they did in the Russia probe. These members of the House and Senate saw this with their own two eyes, and they lived it with their being there at the Capitol. So the level of probing and inquiry is certainly not what it's been in the past. They know what they saw. They know what the president said. It is right out there for everyone to see. And so the decision and the Senate trial on this should not be that difficult. And as I have said before, there needs to be consequences for this kind of action, not just for the president, but for others who also incited the insurrection.
Listen, this is a difficult historic time. We need civil conversations like this. So I appreciate that both of you came to this conversation with that in mind. Thank you very much. Bill Press, a Democrat, Alice Stewart, the Republican. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. STM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Thursday, January 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. stm.mit.edu.
The world was shocked when pro-Trump extremists stormed and seized the U.S. Capitol. Throughout this tumultuous era, the NPR Politics podcast has been there every day explaining and making sense of the news. We'll be doing that through the final days of the Trump administration as we all try to understand how this moment happened and what will come next.
The FBI is investigating a racist verbal attack that erupted yesterday during an online funeral service for a civil rights icon here in Phoenix, Arizona. Calvin Good fought for low-income black residents during his 22 years on the Phoenix City Council and beyond. He died in December at the age of 93. We're going to bring in Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego now. She was speaking at the memorial ceremony when that intrusion began. Mayor, what happened?
We were honoring former Phoenix Vice Mayor Calvin C. Good, our longest-serving member of the Phoenix City Council and our second African-American to serve an elected office at the City of Phoenix. In the middle of my remarks, we received what you often now call a Zoom bomb, individuals making terrible racist remarks and really offensive comments interrupted the service, and the live broadcast, the church that was facilitating it, decided to end it.
You said multiple individuals. Do you have any idea who this was?
I heard at least one male voice and one female voice. Other people have reported hearing children or high-pitched voices as well, but it was definitely more than one person making terrible, offensive, racist comments, including using the N-word.
And so you say that it was so bad that it stopped the memorial service for this civil rights icon. What else has the reaction been?
It felt like an attack on our city. You'd have to understand how important Calvin Good was to the City of Phoenix. He was just lying in state, which is the first time we've ever done that for anyone in my time in public life. We've named two buildings for former Phoenix elected officials, Barry Goldwater and Calvin C. Good, and our city's highest civil rights honor bears his name. Vice Mayor Good built so much of modern Phoenix, including our affordable housing complexes. We have bridges over our river that goes through the city that wouldn't exist without him. He changed the face of Phoenix And we felt like we didn't get the chance to appropriately mourn him because of these racist attacks. Mm.
So now what? What's the plan?
So we are going to be able to put online the full service without any racist comments, and we are going to make sure that we continue to advance his legacy. He was a very quiet man, but he would often say there's more work to be done. And this was about as clear of a message as we could get from the city of Phoenix, that we have more work to be done. A silver lining in all of this is we've had business leaders, sports leaders, faith leaders all step up and say we want to turn this into a catalytic moment for our city where we do better. If the goal of these racists was to advance racism, we are committed to making sure they fail.
Mayor, I'm thinking about what happened at the U.S. Capitol last week. People smashing into the building, carrying Confederate flags, wearing anti-Semitic sweatshirts, members of far-right extremist groups. I know it's hard to make the connection between that event and the one you're talking about here in Phoenix, but there certainly is a theme running through these incidents here. Is that fair to say?
It seems that we've always had huge challenges with racism, anti-Semitism, but people are feeling comfortable expressing those publicly in a way that makes me deeply concerned about our country, our civil discourse. This attack felt like an attack on the city of Phoenix, just as the Capitol attack felt like an attack on our entire country. It does not represent who we are as a city or as a country, and we have to condemn it, and then we have to make sure that we stop this reprehensible behavior.
That was Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
It's a solemn and stark day in the nation's capital. 15,000 U.S. troops stand by in D.C., more than in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. Let that sink in. Fencing, barricades, and military tents surround the Capitol complex. Soldiers are guarding Congress as members debate impeaching President Trump for the second time. Here's how House Speaker Nancy Pelosi opened that debate.
We know we experienced the insurrection that violated the sanctity of the people's capital and attempted to overturn the duly recorded will of the American people. And we know that the President of the United States incited this insurrection, this armed rebellion against our common country. He must go. He is a clear and present danger to the nation that we all love.
NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales joins us from the Capitol. Claudia, Democrats urged Vice President Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment to remove President Trump from power yesterday. He's refused to do so. So now Democrats are leading the charge on impeachment. But realistically, Trump's immediate removal is unlikely, and he's leaving office next week anyway. So how are Democrats explaining the importance of impeaching him now?
They are saying there must be accountability for the deadly insurrection at the Capitol just a week ago today, and the president must face consequences for his actions at a rally before the attack, and other calls from him for action from those opposing the election of incoming President Joe Biden. The actual article of impeachment is just 4 pages, but it charges Trump with gravely endangering the country and interfering with a peaceful transfer of power. And as we heard moments ago, that he remains a threat to national security. We've heard Pelosi and others echo that. The article also notes that the 14th Amendment to the Constitution prohibits anyone who is engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the United States from holding any office. So this could have additional consequences for his ability to serve in government again.
So that's what Democrats are saying. And some Republicans are joining, but most are not. Here's Representative Jim Jordan, who was one of Trump's staunchest defenders during the first impeachment, and he took the lead in defending him again today.
Democrats can investigate the president of the United States, try to impeach him, investigate him for 4 years, but will not look at an election that half the electorate have their doubts about. I said this last night. I do not know where all this goes, and this is frightening for the country.
Now, we should reiterate that there is no evidence of widespread voter fraud in the 2020 election, and the doubts that Jordan mentioned are based on misinformation, but that is one rationale. Claudia, how are other Republicans explaining their opposition to impeachment?
Similar to Jordan's claims, he's not an outlier here so far. He's part of this core group of House Republicans who are fierce supporters of the president even until the end of his term here. And they're focusing on division, and they say that impeachment will further divide the country. And we should note, this is ironic, at least coming from members who fueled this disinformation, that somehow these election results could be overturned, and that some say was also part of the wave of words that helped incite these mobs to attack the Capitol. And now they seem to be trying to claim to be hitting a note of unity now that Democrats and even some Republicans are hoping to hold this president accountable and have him impeached.
Claudia, can I just ask you to sort of set aside your reporter's notebook for a moment and just share some of your personal experience today, because you're in the Capitol building right now and had to go through unprecedented security measures to get in there. Just tell us what it's been like there. Set the scene.
Yes, it's very different, unlike anything I've ever seen here before. They have a much larger perimeter around the Capitol complex, several layers of law enforcement officials, barricades, multiple barricades, having to check in with multiple officials as you check in, doing multiple screenings just to get into the chamber. Reporters had to do an additional layer of checks. And so we are seeing some unprecedented security here. We're seeing hundreds of members of the National Guard here posted inside of the Capitol Visitor Center. Some are actually sleeping here overnight while they work the perimeter of the building when they are on shift. And then we have, of course, U.S. Capitol Police and others who are adding to that kind of extra layer of watching out for any concerns. But it's put folks, if you will, a little bit on edge, because it's a reminder of what we saw here just a week ago today and the protection that's been called for since.
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, stay safe, and thank you for your time. That's NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales.
Thank you.
We'll take a break from impeachment now to consider more fallout from the pandemic. An estimated 3 million public school students in the U.S. haven't been able to attend class consistently since the outbreak began. That includes thousands of students in metro Atlanta. Martha Dalton with member station WABE reports that school districts there aren't penalizing them for not showing up.
So I'm going to put you in a breakout room.
Crystal Wells is teaching a remote lesson to her fifth grade language arts class. Wells teaches in Atlanta Public Schools, which has been learning virtually since the pandemic started. The district says at least 90% of its students are able to log on each day. But that means up to 5,000 kids aren't regularly at school.
We know for some students, those barriers have been things that are more affective, like maybe mental health or, you know, some difficulty with, housing and things of that nature.
Katika Lovett is chief of schools for Atlanta Public Schools, or APS. She says schools are constantly working with families to figure out what's keeping students from logging on.
For some students, the engagement piece is simply an issue of connectivity.
APS, like many other school systems around the country, has armed families with laptops and Chromebooks and even handed out free Wi-Fi hotspots. But hotspots can get overwhelmed, Lovett says. Some schools are letting students come to campus to use their internet connection. Nearby DeKalb County School District has also been remote since the pandemic started. Superintendent Cheryl Watson-Harris says at the beginning of the school year, about 89% of students were logging in. More than 10,000 students were not.
Everyone really worked feverishly over those first few weeks to ensure that all students that needed a school department-issued device received one, as well as donations from community leaders, elected officials, some celebrities, really coming together and making sure that we got the devices in the hands of the students.
Those gigantic efforts brought the login rate up to 97%, but that means about 3% of students, or 3,000 kids, are still what the district calls non-engaged.
I have to give our state superintendent credit for coining this phrase, but it's something that we've adopted here. You know, it's really compassion over compliance. So it's really not about, hey, you're not here, you know, X, Y, or Z is going to happen. It's more, hey, what's going on? How are you doing? How can we support your family during this time?
The district's coordinator of social work services, Denise Revels, and her team have visited students' homes when they haven't been able to log on. She says some parents of younger kids have trouble helping them with technology.
So we've had to supplement that with giving them hard copy packets at time, you know, because the technology just wasn't working for them. It created almost a barrier.
A barrier during a pandemic when technology is seen as a unifying force.
Sometimes you do need to actually just sit with someone and just look at them eye to eye and say, you know, are you okay? I'm here for you. So staff members have been doing that when that's been needed.
The districts emphasize they're not visiting homes to act as the truancy police during the pandemic and punish parents. They're trying to remove barriers to learning, like hunger.
Some of my team members just said, I'm just going to send a pizza over here or what have you, just so that the family could eat.
In Fulton County, another Atlanta school system, learning is remote temporarily due to the state's soaring rates of the coronavirus. Fulton has about the same number of so-called non-engaged students as DeKalb, just over 3% or 3,000 kids. Cliff Jones is Fulton's chief academic officer. He says there are typically three reasons why students may still miss classes: technology and two others that are particular to high school students.
They are home taking care of their siblings. Also from the older kids, they're working. You know, many of our families are impacted economically during this time of COVID in ways that are truly heartbreaking. And so the older kids are having to work to go out and bring money and food home.
While districts support these students at home, they also have to prepare for them to eventually return to school. So they're increasing services like counseling and tutoring, and they'll be offering free summer programs for students who've missed out on learning because of the pandemic. For Here and Now, I'm Martha Dalton in Atlanta.
We're going to take a break from the day's historic events to talk about celery. I have some simmering in a crock pot at home to help make some stock, and I like ants on a log, but that's the extent of my celery recipe list. And maybe yours too. So Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst is going to show us some surprising ways celery can be used in delicious dishes. She joins me now. Hey there, Kathy.
Hi there.
So you say it's time to rethink celery. What do you mean by that?
Well, it is not the obvious food. Like, when's the last time you heard someone say, wow, I just ate the best stalk of celery? I mean, it's like the middle child. It's dependable. It's so ignored, and it's often seriously undervalued. It's the one vegetable you can almost always find in the grocery store, and it's crisp, and it's green, and it's crunchy, and it's actually incredibly flavorful, and it's inexpensive. And it's just constantly relegated to the status of diet food. So I want to rethink that.
Well, let me ask you about the diet food, because, of course, there's this, I don't know if it's a myth, maybe you can fact check me, that actually it's a negative calorie food because you burn more in the act of chewing the celery stalk than is actually in the celery stalk. Is that true?
Well, it has not been scientifically proven. According to the Mayo Clinic, the idea of this negative calorie food, because it's so full of water and fiber, it's a 7 to 10 calories per stalk. So it's really negligible. But is it burned up when you chew it? I don't know. Do we care? 7 calories? There should be more delicious foods like that.
All right, fair enough. And we know there's a few calories, I'm sure, in these recipes that you're going to share with us. So let's dig into that. You're bringing us some recipes, starting with a celery salad. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I had some fresh fennel, which has a sort of a subtle licorice flavor. So I took some celery and I lightly peeled it. And I just want to stop for a second and talk about that. Like, why would you peel celery? The outer stalks of a celery can be quite fibrous. And if you just take your vegetable peeler and give it one or two runs along the outside of the peel, it tenderizes the celery. You get to the more tender root of it. So I took the celery, lightly peeled it, chopped it into half-inch size pieces. Then I thinly sliced fresh fennel. And then I took a piece of Parmesan cheese and I shaved that with the vegetable peeler as well, sprinkled scallions on it and the fronds, the dill-like top of the fennel bulb, and then added lemon juice and olive oil and salt and pepper. So simple, but incredibly fresh and vibrant salad for these winter days.
It sounds delicious, and I love that tip about peeling the outer part of the stalk, because, of course, one of the knocks on celery is that it is so fibrous. So that's interesting that not the whole thing, it may just be the outside. And you're also bringing us a recipe for celery soup that uses not just the stalk, that is probably what people most recognize with the celery, but also the root. How does that work?
So celery root, which is also called celeriac, is actually a different root. It is full of celery flavor. It's found near root vegetables in your grocery store. And I decided to make a very warming winter soup by chopping up celery root and fresh celery stalks, sauteing them with leeks or onions, and then throwing in some vegetable or chicken stock. And what's revelatory about this soup, if I do say so, is how creamy and full-flavored it is, and there's not a drop of dairy in the soup. And then if you wanted to get fancy, I sauteed some celery in olive oil with a little bit of capers and sprinkled that on top of this very rich but simple celery soup. And it's a very warming dish for a cold day.
And I have to say, it looks quite creamy, which is not usually the adjective we think of when we think of celery. In the moment that we have left, Kathy, I understand you can also bake celery. Tell us about a baked celery dish.
Yeah, you can bake it, you can braise it, but I decided this is the rich dish. This is the non-diet dish. I made a gratin, which takes sweet celery, cuts it into chunks, tops it with milk, a little heavy cream, and grated cheese, and you bake it until it's soft and gooey and cheesy and... it's pretty irresistible. I could go on and on. The thing about celery is that it's hugely adaptable. You need to think beyond your tuna fish sandwich or your potato salad.
Any quick tips then, Kathy, for buying the celery and then keeping it fresh once you have it?
Yeah, you want to look for tightly formed bunches of celery. The stalk should be quite green, and there should be a kind of healthy head of celery leaves at the top. And by the way, the celery leaves are totally edible. You can chop them and sprinkle them on foods the way you would with parsley, but you'll get a slight celery flavor. And then when the celery looks kind of wilted and, you know, sad, you can use that to make stocks, vegetable stocks, chicken stocks. So there are many ways to use the entire plant.
You gotta like that versatility. You can use it at its fresh peak and maybe when it's a little past its prime. We've been talking celery with Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunston. We'll have all of these tips and recipes for celery at hereandnow.org. Kathy, thanks so much.
Thank you. Great to talk to you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. I do not like celery. Sorry, it's Here and Now.